Now, we can provide week in, week out entertainment, but we actually want to see our players on TV shows. We want to see them on chat shows. We want to see them on children's TV. We want to see them inspiring the next generation. And that, for me, is what a really good agent can do.
Hey everyone, I'm Katie Traxton and welcome to Anatomy of an Agency, the podcast that brings you everything you need to know about the talent agency world. We speak to athletes, past and present, promoters, producers, actors, marketing execs, basically anyone you could think of who has dealings with talent agents. In this episode, we speak to Jason Ferguson, who is chairman of the World Professional Billiards and Snooker Association, which basically means he's in charge of snooker everywhere. We asked him what the real responsibilities of his job are.
The World Snooker Tour would be our most famous product, which is over 20 events that goes around the world. Major broadcast, and that's been running for many, many years. Outside of that, we develop the sport properly. We're heavily into sports development. That includes the women's game, the disability sport, the real grassroots as well, sort of bringing that talent through from a very young age. So actually, we're a full and complete sport. That's what we are.
Lots of talent.
There are lots of talent, yes. And, and it's great to see. We're having a real good time, actually, of younger players coming into our sport. We've had a little bit of an age gap. Some of the players that have been on the tour for a long time have stood the test of time. But actually, we can see a little bit of change of the tide. So new, young players that can be easily influenced are now, coming onto the tour, and we're trying to provide those services as well to try and bring them into the right forum. As part of that, we've actually set up something called WPBSA Players. So WPBSA stands for the World Professional Billiards and Snooker Association. It's a very old organisation. But we've set up a players' arm of that. What that is, it's really experienced players and executives providing services for players and advice. So within,
it's like unionised mentoring.
It is, yeah. What you've got, you have around 30 players change over each year. So we're 128 players on the World Snooker Tour. Some drop off the tour, some bounce back quite quickly, some disappear for a few years and come back. But what you have got is probably around 20 players that are new. You may see them for the first time. Some of them can be quite young. I think last year we had young Stan Moody, who was 16. We had young Hungarian through this year, Bulsi Revez, 17. So we've got some real good, strong talent coming in. What we want to see, actually, is agents coming through and setting those players on the right path, because that's good for everybody.
And are they?
Well, I think our sport is only really just maturing into that big worldwide environment where good agents are becoming necessary. What we've seen over the years is really parents or family friends or something, working with players, or more as company, really, travelling with company, or a coach travelling with a player. The real top quality agents, they're only just starting to come into our sport. It's really important that we get this right. Two reasons, really. One, we want the player themselves to enjoy their time with us. We want them to be guided properly. We want them to earn properly. But actually, the second reason is we want them to do the right thing, say the right thing, because that's good for the brand and good for the sport. So it's a win-win, and so we're investing in this area. Are they doing the right thing? Look, it's too early to say. I think every sport will be able to talk about horror stories and players getting tied up in the wrong contracts or getting involved with the wrong people. Or getting stuck into the wrong relationships with the wrong people. Anti-corruption is a big drive for me these days. As a governing body, executive, we're constantly, monitoring betting markets. We're trying to keep our sports so clean, and we're actually very good at it. We're one of the sports that really has a zero tolerance approach. What you don't want is young players coming in that have perhaps already been influenced. So there's another part of being an agent that we want to see improve is actually we want players to be on the right track, stay on the right track, and stay with us for a long time.
And is it quite an insular community in snooker and billiards? So are the agents that you're seeing also representatives of football, rugby, Olympic athletes, or do they tend to represent snooker players?
I think our sport has been quite insular, and I think that's perhaps from where it's come from. In the last 15 years, it's gone from 6 predominantly UK-based sports up to 20 plus major events around the world. So the sport's grown enormously. Historically, it's been quite insular. There are one or two agents around that are doing a really good job. Ronnie O'Sullivan has an agent that is putting him in the right areas. People need professional agents to do the job properly.
What are the right areas?
Well, you want your players to do the right thing, say the right thing. We've mentioned that already, but we actually want them to live a full life as a professional sports person. And when I say live a full life, now we can provide week in, week out entertainment, but we actually want to see our players on TV shows. We want to see them on chat shows. We want to see them on children's TV. We want to see them inspiring the next generation. And that for me is what a really good agent can do. Secondly, it's impossible for a player to represent themselves properly in any negotiation. You'll know this, Katie, as an agent.
It's impossible for any of us, I
think. Yeah, but so what you have is a lot of players in our sport. We've got enormous television coverage. I mean, just to give you an idea, our television goes to 1.8 billion homes around the world. We must have one of the biggest television outputs in the world of any sport. It's huge, and the hours are huge as well. And the dedicated fan base following is also in the hundreds of millions. So it's an enormous sport in terms of that output. What that does is it puts that young player on television against a huge star straight away, day one. Now, what that means is that they have some value in their own IP, but they also have some value in the logos that they're wearing. Okay, some of that we're going to say you've got to wear this, but actually they've got spaces of their own. We want to see players with high quality brands working with real companies, doing a job for everybody.
We want to see the first snooker player on Strictly.
Well, I mean, Sean Murphy, who actually is the chairman of our players board, former world champion, still in the top 16. He has mentioned it a few times. He's got the glitz, the glamour, and he's got the talk, and I'm sure he'd do very well. Plays a bit of piano as well. So I think there is some value in that. I mean, we used to have a game show many years ago called Big Break.
Like everyone's seen it.
Yeah, of course. Well,
John Virgo, Jim Davidson.
There you go. So that type of show did wonders for us as a sport. There were huge numbers. It was peak time, broadcast hours, 7 o'clock on a Saturday night. Everybody was sat watching the TV. There were less channels then, of course. But what that can do for your sport, it is terrific, and it brings out the characters. We're actually not in the sports business, we're in the entertainment business. When players go out in that arena, they entertain millions of people with drama on the table, but actually they are characters. And I think our sport has a little bit of a, it's so intense that the players are so focused, and they really probably, the characters don't come out on the actual broadcasting events. But their characters do come out, of course, after the match, when they're chatting in the hotels or whatever else. We have some great characters on our tour, and I'd love to see more of that come out. The way to get that out is working with proper agents like you.
You said that Ronnie O'Sullivan has a great agent, but famously, he hasn't always said and done the right thing. Is that fair? Is that part of his brand? Is that part of showing character?
I mean, Ronnie is a character. He has an agent, obviously, doing his commercial activities. Ronnie is Ronnie O'Sullivan. He is who he is, and he's a huge star in this sport, and he's a huge entertainer on the table. He's an incredible talent. He's the best player we've ever seen. I've known Ronnie O'Sullivan since he was probably 10, 11, 12 years old, and he's always been just an amazing talent. Sometimes, he and I, we don't see eye to eye, quite frankly, because, I govern a sport. I want everybody to say the right thing all the time for the sport. And Ronnie, at times, has been quite controversial and has fallen foul of the rules from time to time. So, that's just Ronnie.
But conflict is not bad for entertainment. I keep thinking as you're talking about Luke Littler and the sudden breakthrough where you go from, again, if you look at darts, one kind of game show that your average householder can refer to and maybe you play down the pub, to most people not really being engaged with the elite level athletes. And then suddenly, overnight, one young man becomes a household name. What would need to happen for that to just occur in snooker?
Well, actually, we have, and I say this because I was part of the design of it, we have the most perfect system in our sport. We can take a player, let me put it this way, if you were a snooker player today and you thought that you were good enough to win the world championship and be the biggest star in the sport ever seen, you can do it in a matter of months in our sport. Now, it wasn't always that way. The old-fashioned IF sport structures are too slow in this instance. Now, I'm not saying that's every sport, but it's certainly in our sport. What we've done, we've rewritten the whole thing. We've got challenge tours, we've got qualifying systems, we've got world junior events, we've got world amateur events, we've got women's events. The World Women's Snooker Tour is a qualification tour for women to access the World Snooker Tour. We're a true mixed gender sport. So we could take you could win the World Women's Championship, you could be on the World Snooker Tour, you could be in the World Snooker Championship qualifying by March, April, and by the end of April, first week in May, you could be the biggest star in our sport.
Well, I think I've got somewhere
today
to be, Jason.
There you go.
So basically what you're saying is you're structured for meteoric rises, which is exactly what both the commercial and the entertainment world want.
Exactly. That's what we are. But actually, it's been done based on opportunity for all. I hate structures that hold talent back. There are so many organisations, I see. We used to have it in our sport. Well, if you're good enough, you'll get to there. Oh, if you're a bit better, you'll get there next year. You know, you're 3 years to just try and get to this level. Now you can do it in a few months. That's how it should be. There's only one rule. You just need to be good enough.
The dream agent comes in. Where are you hoping that they take their mentee, their protege to?
It's a really good question. And one that I do have an answer for, because I want to see that.
I think you've got it all.
I want to see that. No, trust me. We're working on it. It's work in progress, always. But we do want to see that young player go into the right arrangements. Now, that might be arrangements just to make sure that player's career stays on track. But actually, what we want to see really is that player working with major brands. Because major brands working with athletes will clearly add major brands to the sport as well. So the perfect agent for me would be, again, utilising that player's image, own IP, going into various, I don't care if it's the opening of a supermarket, anything. But I want to see those players out and about in the mainstream, outside of the sport, doing activities that everybody will see and watch. And that will popularise the sport even further. So that's a start. Secondly, again, seeing those players wearing very high quality brands, logos on their waistcoats. We're quite a unique sport. We don't have football shirts. We don't have, you know,
much more dapper.
We've got a sport where you go to work in a dinner suit. I mean, come on, it's quite classy. So, but part of that is, it does give you the opportunity to look at high-end brands. It does give you the opportunity to look at design. Again, I mentioned earlier that we have women and men playing on the tour together. We've seen some really, you know, nice designs. You know, somebody once said to me, you know, women shouldn't be wearing a waistcoat. Well, why? Well, there's plenty of nice things out there.
I think they look fantastic in waistcoats.
So look, we I want to see the players working with brands, working with tailors, working with, you know, anything that looks great. I mean, we have got some really great assets on our tour. I mean, we've got some really strong talent coming through, men and women.
This may not have been your dream, but look at the waistcoat deal that Gareth Southgate got with M&S.
There you go.
Case in point.
Yeah. Does he play snooker? I don't know. Gareth Southgate. Gary Lineker does. He's very good.
Well, there you go. There you go. My question would be, though, if this happens, there's always, for every positive that happens, there's always a potential backlash, right? I think of it like snakes and ladders. Every time you go up a ladder, there's always a potential snake around the corner. What happens if somebody comes along, an agent, even if they're really well-intended, they get your young player, they get them in all these spaces, but but the young player gets stars in their eyes and there isn't a precedent for them to understand that they really need to be focused on their sport. What some might say, I'm not saying whether I agree or not, some might say the Marcus Rashford effect. Marcus Rashford gets a certain amount of success and then suddenly he's needed in so many other places that actually, is he playing good enough football to get selected for the team next time? How would you guard against that?
There is always a danger of that. Somebody makes it big. And I think a great example is if somebody wins our World Snooker Championship, yeah, it's well known that the time pressures on that player are huge. And actually, very few come back and just keep winning and winning and winning. Kyron Wilson, our world champion this year, he's broken the mould. He's come back, won a couple of major tournaments. He's kept himself on track. Works with his brother as his agent, actually. He's actually doing a very good job and keeping Kyron on track. So there are dangers that people get pulled in the commercial direction and the form suffers. Likewise, there are dangers that there's not enough of that and they lose the opportunity. So the balance is right. What we do have in our sport is a whole host of services that are offered to snooker players. So our players' body provides induction training for new players coming on tour. That may also include some mentoring and you know, people working alongside them. We have mental health support. We have an endless supply of coaches in the sport, which is just one of the things I'm really proud of, is the number of coaches we've got. Again, we can point that player. We can guide them in the right direction. What we can't do is the agent's job for them, because that is their own individual care that's needed. And we represent the sport and all 128 players on the World Snooker Tour. It's very hard for us to do the individual job, but we can provide the advice and guidance and try and keep them on the right road. We can also provide, you know, legal support if it's needed and advice along those things. Accountants, you know, all these things are in place.
Honestly, I'm not actually sure I've come across a sport that has all of these things sorted and in place before, which makes me increasingly tempted to come on tour, but I have a podcast to make. So when is the right time in the young, talented snooker player's journey to find this agent?
I think there's probably two levels of that. We very often see players that have been looked after locally. There's some localisation, it might be local businesses or some might be the person that owned the snooker club that they came from looking after them. The next level is, I mean, that care could be quite good and it could be what got that player to that point. If that player goes on and becomes an international sports star, there is another level of agent required. That's where that real level of professionalism, understanding the marketplace, understanding the sports business, understanding media, television, you know, that's very often another level. I don't see any reason why that both of those things can work together, hand in hand. And we do see this from time to time. An agent will just be responsible for commercial activities, and a player may have we call that a road manager or an agent that just works with him on local things. So there are some different levels of it, I think. But for us, perfect time would, you know, end of the World Snooker Championship, a pre-qualifying starts for the following year. We, at this point, we know which players are joining the tour going forward. We start that induction training. The right time is to check those players and make sure they're all okay. Make sure they've got somebody looking after them, because life on tour is tough.
And what is scouting like for young talent in snooker? Because you spoke a lot about inclusivity, men and women and para snooker players, but in terms of all different diverse communities, is that scouting system in place to genuinely find the best talent in the world?
I wouldn't say it's a scouting system. What we have is a system of events and qualification. So we know as a sport, if we're running the World Amateur Championships in Morocco, which we are in January, by the way, if you do fancy it.
Coincidentally.
It's a nice destination. Saidiya Beach, it's a lovely five-star hotel on the beach, all inclusive, I'm selling it to you. So if a player comes through that system, we kind of know where that player's come from usually. There'll be players from all over the world there. Some of them will have agents. Some of them will be lonely and on their own and travelling with friends.
We don't want that.
What comes from that is an understanding of the marketplace. Because we're an active sport, we don't sit in the office in Bristol. thinking it's all going to come to us. We are absolutely on the ground everywhere. And we've got a network that we work with. We've about 100 countries with national governing bodies, with national championships and some kind of structure. There's about 50 or 60 of those that are really active. And there's probably 20 or 30 that are really strong. And some of those we work with at the professional tour as well as the lower level. But we'll have an understanding, because we monitor and track results, form, performance. We'll have that understanding. Agent scouting, I'm not seeing it in our sport yet.
And you know what's really interesting there about you saying that you're an active sport? I think this is a brilliant note to end on, is that that is pretty much exactly also what we want to see in the world of agents. There's far too much of people being booking agents or basically PAs to talent, and not enough of people proactively going out there and trying to help these people build their careers, build their brands, and take the world by storm.
Absolutely. I completely agree with that. And, you know, what I will end by saying, we would love to see more agents, more active, commercial, strong agents in our sport. I think it would help us enormously.
Sounds great, Jason. Where do we sign? But before we sign off, we would like to bring to you our brand new feature, Legal Corner, in partnership with law firm Hugh James. They have agreed to answer all of the questions that we really, really want the answers to in the talent industry, but you just don't know where to find them. Here is the question that Jason wanted the answer to.
What are your best tips for national governing bodies on how to manage the seemingly ever-increasing governance and integrity requirements they face?
We are joined by Hugh James lawyer, Mark Loosemore.
So I think the first thing is they should be building into their process some sort of annual review of their governance documents, at least an annual review. And often what I find is they don't have that annual review process, but also when they do have that process, they start with possibly the least important documents. So they might be reviewing a small competition set of rules rather than starting with their articles of association or statutory changes. So the law changes, you know, ever changing. And so they need to start by looking at, well, what changes of the law there have been that might affect our documents, but then also start with the most important documents, which is usually their articles of association, and then work down from there. And you know, if they were members of a quality mark scheme, they'd have to evidence, say ISO 9001 or something like that, they'd have to evidence that they did that on an annual basis. But in any case, they probably need to do it, if they're being funded by UK Sport or Sport England, they probably need to do it on an annual basis anyway. They're supposed to be doing it, but often they're not. And that's what we're trying to nip in the bud problems, and we're trying to catch problems early and take preventative steps, rather than a problem happens and then we're taking steps to try and tackle, you know, the problem after it's occurred, which is usually expensive and usually very time consuming and racks up loads of management effort, which, you know, we want to try and avoid. Otherwise, I think they should look at asking for help, you know, look at the funding bodies. Are there any central services that they're offering which might help them? Are there template documents that they can take advantage of and then look to tailor to their own circumstances? And then obviously I would say, but take some independent legal advice. You know, get that advice up front before the problems have happened rather than when they've happened.
How do the steps you should take differ depending on how big and how rich a governing body you are?
It really doesn't matter that much. I mean, obviously their problems or their challenges and their business might be more complicated. So it is about proportionality, you know, what's appropriate in terms of, say, I mean, let's just pick an example, like an anti-doping policy for a small governing body might look very different to a large and complex governing body. But fundamentally, they need to have that document in place. It needs to be a practical document that doesn't just sit on a shelf or on a drive on their computer and never gets referred to. It needs to be a living document that they're using. And then they need to review it on an annual basis at least, and keep it up to date and keep it refined and improved as they go along.
Within the governing body, whose responsibility is it to be aware of what's in that document?
I mean, it's the executive team, it's the board. I mean, ultimately, the board of directors are primarily responsible for running the company. So often they're relying on their executive team to be effective on a day-to-day basis. So directors need to switch on to this stuff, and you know, they might not be raised with them often by the executive team, but they need to be alive to it and make sure that they've got those review processes in place.
And what's the difference between being a national governing body in the UK and being an international governing body but with an HQ in the UK and who is a registered business in the UK?
Well, they're both subject to English law if they're based in England, but obviously the regulatory framework in which they operate is different. So if they're an international governing body, they may be accountable to the International Olympic Committee if they're an Olympic sport, but in some sports they won't be. If you take FIFA's not accountable to any higher body. However, it does have to comply with international law. It does have to comply with national law in the jurisdictions in which it operates. And it is held accountable from time to time by the courts. You know, whereas the national governing body has also got to be accountable to the likes of, say, UK Sport or Sport England, who are providing funding. So there are subtle differences between the landscapes in which they operate.
Thank you, Mark. We will definitely be doing our due diligence, and we hope that you will be doing yours and listening to every single episode of Anatomy of an Agency. Other than that, for now, from me, it is goodbye.